America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Human Rights Watch calls for a stronger arms embargo as the UN waits Sudan sanctions.
We believe that the existing embargo is not sufficient, that there needs to be a wholesale embargo on the sale of armed and military equipment to the whole of Sudan.
Eswatini says it is not an enemy of any country, including China. An influential civil society group issues an ultimatum for Nigerian President Bola Tinubu to reverse a recent fuel increase. The Nigerian Labour Congress calls for the immediate and unconditional release of its leader, who was arrested and detained yesterday, Monday.
We say that he should be released immediately and unconditionally. But we are also gracious enough to give the state what we call a reaction time. And that reaction time extends to 12 midnight tonight.
And Vice President Harris and former President Trump meet face-to-face for a crucial debate today, Tuesday. We'll also examine Africa's view about the debate. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United Nations Security Council is expected to vote this Wednesday on whether to renew existing sanctions that prevent the transfer of military equipment to Sudan's western Darfur region. The pending vote comes as Human Rights Watch calls on the council to expand an existing arms embargo on the restive region to the rest of the country. Mohamed Yusuf has more.
The Western Darfur region has been the epicenter of Sudan's current civil war, which pits the Sudanese Armed Forces, or SAF, the Paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, and other militias against each other. UN agencies and rights groups say the parties involved have committed war crimes and other human rights violations during the conflict, which has lasted nearly 18 months. Ahead of Wednesday's vote, Human Rights Watch is urging the council to consider imposing an arms ban on the entire country to stop the ongoing rights violation and the suffering of the people. The Sudanese government opposes the expansion of the embargo. Human Rights Watch investigators found that some of the weapons being used in the conflict were acquired after the civil war broke out in April of last year. Jean-Baptiste Golopa is a senior researcher in Human Rights Watch Crisis, Conflict and Arms Division.
We based our research on an analysis of photos and videos posted on social media and primarily taken by the fighters themselves, showing them in possession and using equipment such as attack drones, drone jammers, anti-tank guided missiles, as well as truck-mounted multiple rocket launcher systems and mortar munitions.
The rights group's report shows that some of the mortars fired were manufactured in China last year. Companies in Iran, Russia, Serbia and the United Arab Emirates have also produced some of the weapons used, according to the organization. In 2004, a year after the start of another Darfur conflict between ethnic militias and government-backed militias known as the Janjaweed, the UN imposed the arms embargo on Darfur. The embargo originally applied to non-governmental entities and was later extended to all parties in the conflict, including the Sudanese government. Ahmed Hashi is a Horn of Africa political and security commentator. He says the regional and international community is doing little to end the conflict, and says that, in fact, RSF leader Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, better known as Hemeti, is receiving strong foreign support.
I think the United Arab Emirates and other proxy states are arming Mr. Hemeti.
The UAE has denied arming the RSF. Galupa says imposing an arms ban in one region will not solve the conflict. He says a ban is needed nationwide.
We believe that the existing embargo is not sufficient, that there needs to be a wholesale embargo on the sale of armed and military equipment to the whole of Sudan.
The group also is calling on the Security Council to condemn governments that are violating the existing arms embargo on Darfur and take urgent measures to sanction individuals and entities that are also doing so. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
The Nigerian Labour Congress has called for the immediate and unconditional release of its leader, Joe Ajaero, before 12 midnight Monday. Ajaero was arrested and detained Monday at the Nnamdi Azikiwe International Airport in Abuja while en route to the United Kingdom to attend and address the Trade Union Congress of Britain. Benson Upa is the head of information and public affairs at the Nigerian Labour Congress. He tells me that Ajaero's detention is an attack not just on the labor leadership, but also the rights of all Nigerian workers and citizens to organize, protest, and express themselves freely.
The conclusion is that Ajaero should be released on or before 12 midnight. Secondly, there will be a meeting of the National Executive Council at 9 tomorrow. I can also tell you that there's been high level of mobilization already.
You also have put on alert all your branches. What does that mean? What should that suggest?
It is not only our branches, our state councils or the affiliates that we have put on alert. We have also put on the alert, highest possible alert, our civil society allies and other patriotic Nigerians. If it becomes absolutely necessary, we will do the needful. You remember that we have said earlier that this assault on multiple fronts, it's not only against the trade unions or their members, it is against every underprivileged Nigerian. This act of pauperization, intimidation, these acts are not restricted to people in the unions only. Every average Nigerian is a victim or a potential victim. This is the reason why we have asked them to be on the alert, that it is everybody's fight.
Did the government tell you why he was arrested?
No, up to this moment, we have not been told why. And this is typical of a police state. Virtually everything is clandestinely done and to instill fear.
But isn't it true that prior to his arrest, the government had claimed that his activities were of danger to the nation?
No. Yeah, we were not told that his conduct or activities constituted any threat to the nation. And they couldn't have. Because the national interest is our passion. For us, our driving motive has always been the sovereignty, the integrity of Nigeria and the welfare of its people. We do not do that for salary or for wages or for allowances or for budget making. We do that as our way of life. So it is not possible that with such overflowing passion of our country, that we would act in a way and manner that would constitute a threat to that same country. So no one can stand on a moral ground higher than ours and begin to talk to us or lecture us about the security of this country.
Mr. Ajaero was on his way out of the country. Can you tell us what his mission was?
Yes, he was traveling to the UK on the invitation of the ITUC to attend a conference. A conference where issues of interest of organized labor are discussed. It was then he was stopped and picked up at the airport without any warning.
The ultimatum you gave for his release, what time frame do you have?
We said that he should be released immediately and unconditionally. But we were also gracious enough to give the state what we call a reaction time. And that reaction time extends to 12 midnight tonight.
Benson Upa is the head of information and public affairs at the Nigerian Labour Congress. He was speaking with us from Abuja. The Nigerian government spokesperson did not respond to our request for an interview. An ultimatum calling on Nigerian President Bola Ahmed Tinubu to order a reversal of a recent fuel increase expires today, Tuesday, issued by the civil society group called Socioeconomic Rights and Accountability Project, or SARABA. The warning calls on the president to instruct the Nigerian National Petroleum Company Limited, the state regulator, to immediately reverse the recent price increase. This after the regulator announced a rise in fuel price from 37 cents to 54 cents per liter. Kolawole Oluwadere is the deputy director of SARAB. He tells VOA's Peter Clottier that the fuel price increase will further impoverish Nigerians.
The ultimatum is against the background of the removal of subsidy from the amount Nigerians would buy premium motor spirits, which is popularly called petrol. But this is in the direct reaction to the latest increase by the NNPCL, which is Nigerian National Petroleum Company Limited, which is the state-owned enterprise that is the sole regulator and the supplier of petrol in Nigeria, which, of course, has cost Nigerians a lot of hardship. And what we've seen as a sharp contrast between the president's promises for Nigerians to bear with him while he makes policies that will make life better, and the spending of government, particularly the public expenditure that even relates to the president and the vice president itself. So we had the meeting set up with the president for him to direct the NNPCL to reverse the increase in the price of premium motor spirit, also called petrol, and also directly to cause an investigation into the funds, bailout funds that have been sent to the NNPC over the years, the latest being the $300 million bailout that was given to the NNPC since August 2024.
What happens if the call or the ultimatum is not adhered to by the president and by extension the NNPC to reverse the increase in petrol prices?
Well, we may be forced to go to court as part of our public interest in advocacies. Unfortunately, this is one of those things that we think shouldn't form the basis of litigation. But because we're a law-abiding organization, particularly a legal advocacy organization, we will have to go to court. Perhaps when this ultimatum expires today, and if we have not heard from the government acting in the best interest of the people, we will have to go to court to compel the president to act on the best interest of Nigerians, as according to the constitutional oath of office that he took.
In the statement from SERAP, it says the increase in petrol prices constitute a fundamental breach of constitutional guarantees and the country's international human rights obligations. What does this mean?
It means that the laws that guide the conduct of public officers, in this instance, the president, and even the NNPCL being a public institution, mandates the president to act in the best interest of the people. There is a code of conduct for public officers, which includes the president in the constitution, which mandates the president to always act in the best interest of the people. That is also the African Charter on Human Rights, which Nigeria has ratified, which also mandates the president to always consider the socioeconomic rights of the people in the policies that he has made. And within the context of all these laws, this increase cannot be said to promote the welfare of Nigerians.
Kolawole Oluwadare is the Deputy Director of the Socioeconomic Rights and Accountability Project. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 10th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The Kingdom of Eswatini was the only independent African country that did not attend the just-concluded 2024 Forum on China-Africa Cooperation in Beijing. Eswatini also happens to be the only African country that recognizes Taiwan as an independent state. The Associated Press quoted a Chinese foreign ministry spokesperson last week that it was not in Eswatini's interest to develop official diplomatic relations with Taiwan. Government spokesperson Alpheus Zumalo tells me that Eswatini is not an enemy of any country, including China.
We have got no particular or specific reason why we did not, but we were not honored with the receipt of invitation to attend the same, and there is absolutely nothing to be read into it, except that we know as a sovereign state that China is not an enemy to the Kingdom of Eswatini, but the fact is there was no invitation that was particularly extended to us.
Could it be because you have no diplomatic relations with China?
Absolutely not. We interact and deal with mainland China on many aspects within the international system. Further countries, the majority of the countries, have got very warm, secured and growing diplomatic relations with mainland China. The African Union, the same obtain. And as the Kingdom of Eswatini, this is our cardinal foreign policy. We are not an enemy to any country around the globe. So there is absolutely no reason why, when we have received an invitation to attend the Africa-China summit, we would not honor that invitation on the basis that we do not have diplomatic relations with China, or we don't work or interact with China in any way within the international framework or diplomatic system.
I read an article last week, it quoted the Chinese foreign ministry saying that your country should recognize the trend and make correct decisions. I wonder, what do you make of that statement?
We truly responded to that statement. Our position is and have always been that China should be more engaging with her diplomatic partners that are attending the China-Africa summit, as opposed to who or which country that have not attended and what are the reasons thereof. So our response is that China is not the Kingdom of Eswatini's enemy. We are not an antagonist to China's interest within the international system. Neither are we lobbying or working for China's isolation to amass whatever diplomatic relations and other probably unnamed benefits that they accrue out of those diplomatic relations. We view mainland China like any other country. As to diplomatic relations established or not, that doesn't give us a leeway or an anxiety to work against the interests of mainland China. That is not the cardinal and the internal dictates of the foreign policy of the Kingdom of Eswatini.
Althea Zumalo is the Eswatini government spokesperson. You were speaking with me from the Eswatini capital, Mbabane. Election officials in Tunisia have doubled down on their decision to deny accreditation to certain election observer groups who are saying the move shows that election in the North African country will not be free and fair. The Associated Press reports that the watchdog group iWatch said the country's election authority has accused them of nefarious motives and taking foreign funds as a pretext to deny them access to the polls. Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump square off Tuesday in Philadelphia for their first presidential debate. Analysts say this rhetorical slugfest, which pits a prosecutorial puncher against one of America's best-known counterpunchers, could be decisive as they vie for the presidency. Viewer's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
In the Republican corner, former President Donald Trump trying to reclaim the title after a four-year break. And in the Democrat corner, Vice President Kamala Harris, the rising challenger who has Americans wondering whether she can go the distance all the way to the Oval Office. Tuesday evening's presidential debate, with its glossy production values, pre-event taunts, and starkly different contenders, feels like a heavyweight bout. Trump's last debate ended with a knockout. Just weeks after President Joe Biden's lackluster late June debate performance against Trump, Biden announced he would not seek re-election. Now, with Harris just weeks into running as his replacement, she faces Trump on the debate stage. But analysts say it's more than a spectacle. This toe-to-toe contest, where both will vie for points from a deeply split electorate, could be decisive. They bring very different styles to the stage. Trump has jabbed at Harris's intelligence and predicts that his odds against her are better than against his last debate opponent, Biden.
He is a smarter person than she is. Oh, they're waiting for the debate.
And here's Harris taking a short break from debate training.
Look, it's time to turn the page on the divisiveness. It's time to bring our country together, chart a new way forward.
June's Trump-Biden debate drew more than 51 million U.S. television viewers. Analysts expect big numbers for this matchup, too, and high stakes for both contenders. Nate French teaches communications at Wake Forest University.
Trump has to prove that he can be president, and he has to prove to a lot of the people who are looking at him that he can be as assertive and as aggressive as he wants to be without being rude, if he's going to try to get anybody that might not be currently on the Trump train. Kamala Harris has to prove that she's presidential. She has to prove that she can attack and she can pull back. She has to prove that she can identify where her policies are different than Biden, but still moving in the same Democratic platform.
Moderators will pepper the candidates with questions on major issues like the economy, reproductive rights, foreign policy, and more. Each candidate, given only a pen, paper, and water, has 2 minutes to reply. Jeremy Suri is a history professor at the University of Texas at Austin.
To some extent, the debates give the two candidates a pass because they can state the things they want to do, their aspirations, without having to explain how they will do them. But where it becomes significant is they have to at least say, when they articulate their positions, what they think that will look like.
It all happens here in Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love, on Tuesday night. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
The crucial Tuesday presidential debate between Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump is being watched closely by Africans. Christopher Isike is the professor of African politics and international relations at the University of Pretoria. He tells viewers Chinedu Ofor that the stakes are high because Africa has a huge stake, not only in the outcome of the debate, but also the November election.
There are a couple of different stakeholders that have interest. Centers like mine following the elections closely because we want to know how it pans out because of the fact that we need to be able to craft foreign policy response for states in the continent to know how to engage who, depending on who wins the elections. And then governments, of course, on the continent also have a stake in who wins. For example, if Harris, the Democrats, were to win, it would mean that a country like South Africa would have some hopes that AGOA will be renewed and it has a chance of being listed again as a beneficiary country. Different stakeholders in the continent have interests. Of course, there are also those who just are interested for the fun of it. But yes, the American politics, because of the leadership position that America plays in the world and is giving its stake in Africa, is something that Africans are always interested in, either at the people level or at the state level.
What would you be looking for in this, what people are terming, make or break debate?
This debate is an opportunity for both candidates to try to sway undecided voters, especially I think that will be their target. They all have their bases firmly locked in, but the undecided voters, independents as they call them also, are the ones to look out for. It's expected to be a close contest in November. I think that's what this debate is going to do, giving them the chance to get to explain their policies, what their policy positions are on key issues that will frame the electors. I will be looking at the economy, and that's what's most important to a lot of Americans. The question of immigration, women's reproductive rights will be also featuring, and I think there's also going to be a bit of foreign policy as well. So those are the things you want to look out for, apart from the fact that it presents Kamala Harris an opportunity for Americans to get to know her more, as the debate is not going to be scripted. There are no props or notes allowed. So it will just be the candidates themselves responding intellectually, or as the case may be, to questions that will be asked of them and presenting themselves to the American public.
In politics, people might say there's a defining moment in every politics or in every campaign. Do you think one way or the other, whatever happens in this debate would affect the outcome of this election? Some say a lot of people have made up their minds already.
Yes, a lot of people have made up their minds already, but there's the narrative that the Trump campaign is pushing that Kamala Harris is not able to respond to questions when he's not the one doing the prosecution, right? And there may be people who would want to get to know that part of her and confirm whether that is correct or not.
That's Christopher Isike, professor of African politics and international relations at the University of Pretoria. He was speaking from Pretoria, South Africa, with viewers Chinedu Ofor. For this Tuesday, September 10th edition of Daybreak Africa, we thank you for spending your morning with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Bartin, Washington, wishing that you will have an amazing Tuesday.
This presidential debate happens Tuesday night on American Network ABC, and you can hear it right here on VOA Africa. Join me, Carol Van Dam, and my co-host, Chinedu Afor, as we discuss with seasoned analyst what's at stake as Vice President Kamala Harris squares off against former President Donald Trump in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, for their first debate ever before the November election. Tune in 30 minutes before the debate with our live coverage at 00.